Is that you, Little Octopus?
I'm Laurel.
And I'm Janelle, and you're listening to the Foot Off the Bed podcast, episode 36. And also, if you hear that in the background, it's my mother deciding to make a shake. I finished a bunch of video games over the break, now that I'm sitting here thinking about it. And I'm like, I kind of want to download some more, but I also don't have space. And a second ago, I didn't have space, and then all of a sudden, because Laurel and my other cousins suggested to download Dead by Daylight because I never played it, but I always see videos on TikTok. And the game randomly said, okay, I bought it. It was like, you don't have any space. I was like, all right, I have it. But as soon as I finish another video game, I'll delete that. And then Dead by Daylight to download. And that thing just randomly decided to download on its own. So that was super weird.
But we are excited because now you get to play.
Word. And I don't know if other people have been seeing this. It's been out for a while, but we've been playing The Past Within. It's cool or whatever, but it's mad short. Like, they need to make the game a little bit longer.
It's not short if you're dumb.
That's true. There are moments where I felt like, am I dumb? But it's like, you can't move on unless the other person moves on from what they're doing. So if you mess up, that's it. They're not giving you a hint. They're not telling you, yeah, you got to restart because you messed up. No, they're like, you got to figure it out.
And communication is key.
Word.
Because you got to know everything that one person is doing, everything that another person is seeing. Like, you have to really be in communication.
Yeah. Oh, if we didn't say, The Past Within is a co-op game, so you literally can't play it by yourself. You have to play with another person. And that's how you solve the puzzles. It's in the, if you've ever played the Cube Escape, I think it's called Cube Escape Games. But I forget what the actual production company is called. Or the people who make the, Rusty Lake Games or whatever. They are the creators of it. And their escape games are so fun if you like creepy stuff. Attached to your escape game. So yeah, we've been playing that and it's been cool, but it's super short.
I don't think we finished our second playthrough, did we?
No, we can finish right after this recording. If you got time. I say if you have, what's it called? Steam or, you know, iPhone or Android, you could play it wherever. It's bad fun. Play it with somebody. It's cool.
It is a lot of fun. And also Dead by Daylight is a lot of fun. It's a game that, like, you don't expect it to scare you, but it will. And it could happen at any point in time. It's like, it's not... I definitely scream more than I thought I would playing that game. I'm not even lying to you.
I know it scared me simply off the fact that somebody's chasing me. Like, I'm one of those people where tag got scary after a while, because why are you so intensely chasing after me? Like, why do your eyes look like they have the eyes of a serial killer? I don't like it. So every time I look at Dead by Daylight, I'm like, I'm already probably going to be scared just off of somebody chasing me.
That game is the funniest game to me, like, right after I scream, I'm just dying of laughter. It's so funny. And, like, there's so many characters to choose from for free. Of course, they have, like, the special events or whatever. Like any other game with special characters that you can buy or, like, outfits and stuff. But it's still a lot of fun.
Yeah, it always looks dope when I see videos. I know some of my fave TikTokers have been playing it, and I'm just like, damn. Every time they die, I'm like, that's gonna be me every 5 seconds.
It's almost always me. Always.
But yeah, I can't wait to play Dead by Daylight, but I feel like I need a full day of, like, freedom without interruption. And I have a long weekend because Well, coming up, because Martin Luther King Day is coming up. So I'll be off and free on the Monday. So, in more unfortunate, but maybe not so unfortunate news, this may be our last episode for a while.
Indefinitely.
Right. Yeah. Because our schedules are just all over the place right now with different jobs. I'm taking more tasks on at work. Moody's a fucking manager. It's just like, it's just a lot going on. And it's getting to a point where, of course, we still have joy doing the podcast because we love talking about true crime and we love talking about paranormal stuff. And of course, we love talking about stupid ass movies. But the issue is just the scheduling and, you know, coming out of pocket for a podcast. It takes a lot of money and a lot of time. And it starts to become less joyous when you can't find enough time to dedicate to it.
When you can't find either or.
It's like, there'll be days where the whole week I'm like, okay, I'm going to plan this day to put some time towards the podcast and then just go to bed right after. And then even then I'm like, I don't even have any me time. Or the weekend will come up and I'm like, all right, I'm going to do it this day. And then I do it. But then it's like, we're rushing through the weekend to get this one thing done that should have been fun instead of we're rushing through it. So as Laurel had stated earlier, we just feel right now that it's best to, I don't want to say end the podcast because that sounds like it'll never come back, but maybe regroup, figure out things, get used to our schedules. And if we don't come back, then we love doing this. But if we do, you know, that's amazing too. And it'll be a whole new rebrand because mm-hmm. we'll have more time, obviously, if we end up doing this again. So, yeah.
We're coming to an indefinite pause.
Right. So, we hope you enjoyed this last episode. And, you know, of course, that doesn't mean stop sharing episodes with your friends. Maybe people will convince us to come back. You never know. But, yeah. We're going to, obviously, continue talking about true crime and paranormal shit in our own time, just not with this strict schedule. So, yeah. Enjoy our last episode.
Yep. And for our last episode, we picked one heck of a movie. It's called The Lodge that I've never heard of until we just started watching it. And it's so slow, but like once you're into it, it's a lot, and then also it like does like a little turn for you, and then you're like, wait, and then you're just watching with this confused expression on your face the whole time. It was a lot for me.
It really did feel like that the whole time. I think my face was just like,
yes, I was sitting there like. But yeah, The Lodge is a 2019 psychological horror film that follows a soon-to-be stepmother who, along with her fiancé's two children, becomes stranded at their rural lodge. So, we start off with, I guess the children are like the main characters. But yeah, so we start off with like the introduction of the kids and their mom. And it's already like weird because like we kind of start off inside of a dollhouse and the mom's looking for the kids and she's like crying in the mirror and all this other stuff. And it's just awkward. We watch as she drops the kids off at her, I guess, they weren't really divorced yet, but they were on their way to being divorced. So I don't know what estranged husband, I guess. They were separated for a little bit.
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
So she drops the kids off with her estranged husband, and he's like, oh, we need to talk, while he's like taking Alka-Seltzer or something. And he informs the wife that he wants to finalize their divorce because he wants to marry somebody else. And I was like, okay, that's all well and good because y'all are all separated. But then after he said that, he smiled at her. And I was like, why did he smile? That's an asshole move. Like, why did you smile at her when it's obvious that she is not doing well?
Bruh. That was, like, very weird.
I was like, you trying to rub it in her face or something? Like, hello?
I took it as, like, an awkward smile. Like, he didn't know how to really segue into it. So he did, like, one of those...
Because he was sitting there lying to her the second she walked through the door. She said, is she here? Referencing his newest conquest. He was like, nah, she's not here. And she looked out the window, this girl sneaking through the back gate. Like,
right. I'm like, okay, sir.
God. So I already didn't like the dad.
Yeah, honestly, if you are triggered by, like, suicide, just don't watch that movie, because it's very brutal to watch.
And then things kind of escalate, because after hearing that news, she goes home, the wife goes home, she cleans the house all nice, and then she kills herself. So
that was a brutal scene.
I was like, literally, when I saw it, I was like, oh my God. Yeah, very brutal. So, of course, now the kids are with Dad, and they have to go to the funeral. Funeral was kind of the saddest scene because, for some reason, they blew up black balloons for her, and were releasing the balloons, and her daughter has a doll that's, like, supposed to be her mom. It's made in her mom's likeness. And she ties the doll to balloon so that it can go up with the other balloons, but the balloon just sinks. And I was just like, damn. None of the other balloons had anything on them. Why did you think this heavy-ass doll was going to float in the air with the other balloons? You needed more balloons.
Well, my thing was, I thought people had, like, tied little letters or something, little notes to the balloons. And then I was like, okay, I only see a few with something maybe attached to it. It happened very fast. But when she was, like, sitting there struggling to tie the doll up on the balloon, I was like, this ain't gonna work. Somebody should have told her. Right. I was like, somebody should have told her. But I feel like everybody was being so awkward about it because, you know, death is awkward. And grief is awkward to deal with when it's, like, obviously children and how she died.
Bro, they made it worse, too, because, like, they got a priest who didn't know a thing about her. So he was literally just like, I didn't know her, right. But I know she was a good woman. How do you know that?
How do you know?
That they do, like, AA meetings in and just put a coffin in the middle of all the metal chairs. I was like, what is this? But yes, okay, moving on. The children are with their father now. And of course, the father's trying to find any way to. Is acclimate the right word? His new girlfriend / soon to be wife into the family.
Yeah.
Meaning getting the kids to like her. And he suggests that they go on a trip for Christmas to the family lodge for like the whole break or whatever. But his thing was, he was like, oh, we'll go to the lodge and then I'm going to leave for work for like the rest of the break. And come back on Christmas. And they were like, why would you leave us with her? That doesn't make sense. And originally they said no. And then the kids looked into their dad's fiance and found out that she was the sole survivor of a mass suicide in this cult that she just so happened to be in. And they're watching the whole video that was posted online of her recording everybody being dead. It's kind of brutal, in a sense, if you kind of think about it or whatever, but I just thought that was a weird thing for the kids to be looking up, but or to have found, like, why was that video still there?
Yeah, I thought that was weird. I was like, why would a news article have access to that video? But then I was like, oh, maybe it was the dad. Like, the dad had access to the video because he technically wrote a book about her. Well, wrote a book about cults, and she happened to be one of the subjects. So it's like, okay, maybe he had the video. So yeah, At first I was very weirded out. Well, I'm still weirded out by it. But at first I was weirded out because I thought the news had posted it. And I was like, the fuck?
No, there's some websites that would have stuff like that. Because that's how I ended up finding a lot of stuff that was disturbing. They still have, what's that man's name? The Kool-Aid Man. They got videos of that, of the news helicopters circling around after the fact, so I wouldn't put it past them. But yeah, so after discovering the fiance's past, her name is Grace, by the way, which I also think is ironic. I guess the kids get into their head that they were gonna have some revenge on her for basically causing their mom to commit suicide. So they agree to go to the cabin with this girl. And then the second the dad leaves, everything goes to shit. First of all, I don't think normal kids would have this power, because the things that were happening, I was like, wait. Grace wakes up in the morning to discover that everything she owns is just magically gone. Then she looks in the house. All the food is out of the fridge. All the stuff in the kids' rooms are gone. Everything's gone. And the oldest son convinces her that that they're already dead. And that they're stuck in purgatory and they have to repent for their sins in order to make it on to the next life or whatever. And she, being the sole survivor of a mass suicide, is triggered by this and suddenly goes into like a catatonic state and keeps repeating that she has to repent. And then the dad comes home.
Oh,
and he's like, what the fuck happened? Because there was so much.
Especially because the dog is in the dog bed, frozen to death. She found the dog frozen to death and had to grab that motherfucker. Well, the girl, what's her name, Grace, found the dog. And she's sitting on the steps and they're like, no, we were just playing. This.
It was so much that it's like hard to grasp just the straight plot line, because so much was happening even though nothing was happening.
Yep.
Like she accidentally fell into the ice water. The dog dying, freezing to death because they left the door open by accident. The son pretending to hang himself.
That was the worst part.
When I first saw it, I said, there's no way that he had to have faked this. Because, like, of course I remember seeing, like, him packing equipment. Like, he was going to do something. But, of course, at the time when I saw it, it wasn't in my head. I was just like, oh, my God. And I looked at what was around his neck, and I looked at the way he was hanging. And I was like, yeah, he's not dead. I think he faked that.
Right. After a while, I was like, yo, I feel like they're doing too much to prove stuff to her that they're dead. Like, no, that stuff is being printed out and she's not around. Like, nah, no. not buying it.
And they printed out a fake newspaper clipping that looked exactly like the father's article or whatever that was posted that they watched the video from. It looked like in the same format as that. And I was like, this bold lettering and the paper mm-hmm. that it's on, you had to have known that was fake. And where would they have gotten that from? But she's got PTSD. So of course, she's gonna believe a little bit of it if it's, I guess, strong enough. And I guess they wanted to provoke her and get her to remember what she did or whatever. And they poked the bear a little too hard because now, boom, here she is, back to where she was. And she's going around throwing stuff in the fire, burning herself, and just being all kinds of crazy. Finding the dog dead, that was the last straw.
Mm-hmm. She's like, coming out of the dark and being like, Mia, girl, think she was going to be scared.
Just her sitting outside and them talking about, oh, it was a joke, it was a joke. She sat outside in the freezing cold for like the whole day with no jacket and nothing. And that's when they started to be like, oh, uh-huh. she's going to die if she does that, blah, blah, blah. Oh, now you care.
Right. Now all of a sudden y'all give a fuck. Okay.
But yeah, so after they already force her into this catatonic state, and they don't know how to bring her back to normalcy or normality, whichever one. She starts getting a little more dangerous because she knows where Dad keeps the gun. And now she's walking around the house with it talking about we have to repent. So naturally, anybody would be afraid. And then the dad finally comes home and it's just awkward, like, everything's so quiet. He goes, what was it? He sees the dog is dead in the bed. And he's like, hello? And as soon as he goes upstairs, there's Grace with a gun in her hand. And the kids behind her scared. Now, this is a grown man. And I understand you love this person or whatever. But if you see the person you love holding a gun up to their head saying that they have to prove to you something, I'm not just going to stand there and watch them do whatever. Like, I understand, like, it's a high-stress situation. But the second she pulls the trigger and nothing happens, she would have got tackled. I would have tackled her. Because, I don't know, I just feel like he gave her too much time. He was just really expecting her to give him the gun, right. And it looked like she was not well already.
My thing is, she pointed the gun right at him. Like, why would you not be like, whoa, like...
Basic self-defense, life preservation, nothing.
Right.
He was just like...
Like, I get you don't want to startle her, but it's like, you also should get that gun out of your face. She looks intent on using it on herself. She already tried to use it on herself. Literally pulled the trigger. The thing said click, then she pointed it at you. I guess at that point he thought there were no more bullets, but it's like, I wouldn't even be testing it. She pointed it right at you.
The literal second she clicked and nothing happened, I would have tackled her to the ground. Because you have to take time to like shoot it again, and you can overpower her. She's got a gun in her hand, she's all bloody, the kids are shaking behind her, and you sitting here being regular. I don't know. Well, end of story. He got shot. And now the kids are really stuck with her. And she's crazy now. So instead of just immediately killing everybody, I guess, she decides to have everybody at the table praying before they do the whole mass suicide thing again. Although it probably wouldn't be suicide. It'll probably be murder. But I applaud her for dragging that man down the steps and carrying him and putting him into a chair at the table. Because I know that he must have been heavy. But yeah. that's the basic synopsis of the movie. What would you rate it?
I'm like maybe a 7.5 or 7. Because I feel like, bro, the dad was the villain. I'm sorry. The dad was the villain the whole entire time. But it pissed me off with how stupid he was. Okay, my thing was, the reason why I think he's the villain is because I was like, you stupid as hell for the mom. Their mom just literally committed suicide 6 months ago. Why would you ever think that it's okay to make them go on a trip with her? Fine, you say, okay, we're going to get married. Let them get to know each other. You don't leave this woman that you so-called trust and decide, oh, yeah, I'm just going to leave them with this woman that's a stranger to them after they just lost their mother, and I'm trying to quickly acclimate them and act like nothing is happening, like they're not traumatized from the death of their mother, and be like, yeah, let's put them in a house together while I'm gone. That makes no... And you know this woman is triggered by her trauma.
You could tell he felt like nothing for his wife because she literally just killed herself, and right. I didn't see you shed one tear. I didn't hear you say nothing nice about her except...
At all.
I don't... Who knows where we go when we die?
They sat in the back of the church. Yeah, and who knows where we go when we die?
This is the worst dad right here. The worst dad.
Right. You could have just reassured your daughter. Maybe lie to her a little bit. No, no. Suicide doesn't cause you... Or what she did will not stop her from being loved by God. She's in heaven. Like, you could have lied to the girl. Something.
It was too much.
And you making the son be the sole caretaker of his right. little sister. Like, that's not his job. And the way they dealt with his grief, I'm like, he had every right to say fuck you and then decide. I mean, it was crazy. He shouldn't have done it. But that whole revenge plot was his fucking fault.
It was just evidence that their feelings weren't taken into account. He didn't try to understand how they would feel. He literally just wants his life to be easier. So he was just like, I'm going to force you guys to
right.
like her because I like her and she's going to be a part of this family. And it's just like, it's frustration, it's grief, it's audacity.
Pure audacity.
Because when I watched this movie, I was like, I went from feeling sad for the mom to hating the fiance to feeling sad for the kids, then not hating the fiance, trying to give her a chance, and then suspect of the kids. And it's all of that is just stemming from the dad not doing his job.
Right.
He either could have not told her, the wife, about them getting married, or he could have found a better way to not be an asshole about it.
Right. Because I think, honestly, it seemed like the wife was about to commit suicide either way. Like, he deserves happiness, but it's just that he did not handle the situation that well after. And also, why are you so attracted to mentally ill women? Like, you write in these books about people in cults and you decide to date one of them? Are you crazy?
And then I didn't like that the fiance just decided not to tell him about the medicine that she's taking to help her get through her experience. Because it seemed pretty vital, because the second she went without it, all of a sudden, we can be so easily manipulated. And I'm just like, if you know that that is an after or a side effect of you not taking your medicine, you should probably express how important it is for you to have that. But again, it is solely the dad's fault. But yeah, I was just saying, I would rate this movie like... maybe like a 6.5. just for the psychological part. Other than that, like, it really confused me, and honestly, I'm still confused.
I think it was a very good slow burn, but I think, because I feel like I gave it a 7, or maybe leaning more towards a 7, because I was like, I don't know, I had watched it like a while back when Foot Off the Bed podcast was a blog, and it was just me. I had written about it, and I was super confused about it because I was like not really understanding how she was so easily manipulated and how she went crazy so quickly. Like, I understood that she was in a cult, but it just wasn't making sense. But then I realized, I guess I wasn't paying attention for some parts. Like, I didn't remember that the kids had researched her. So it made a lot of sense that, oh, we're going to go to this cabin and be left alone with her. Now we're going to fuck with her. Like, it made me go, oh, yeah, that's why they fucked with her. They're definitely fucking with her. This is not anything else going on. They are literally just messing with her and trying to act all innocent. But without that context, like, all the stuff that was happening, I was, like, super confused. I thought it was paranormal or supernatural. And then I was like, oh, wait, no, I missed that very important part. So obviously nothing made sense to me the first go around. So I appreciated it better this time. And I was also, I don't know, I mean, I guess it didn't need to be explained, but I was kind of confused as to why the wife was in the state she was. I was like, was it just because he left her? And if so, like, why are we sending this message? But yeah, it's like the way that the movie handled mental illness was not okay, in my opinion.
The way I see it, because, like, it was obvious that the wife was heavily religious, which I think that's the kind of girl he likes. But he ended up cheating on her, and, like, she knew about it. So I guess it could be, like, the emotional wear and tear of, like, knowing that your husband is seeing somebody else, and then y'all get separated and he lives in a whole other house. So all you can assume is that this woman is over there every day, and your children come home from his house saying, oh, she was there again. She was there again. So it's like,
is that what happened? Did I miss it?
It was in, like, a couple sentences. Cause, like, she was getting the kids ready to leave, and they didn't want to go to the dad's house because they didn't want to see her. So I remember them complaining, like, is she going to be there? And the mom was, I don't know.
Yeah, I remember that part.
And she's in the mirror, and she's, like, dolling herself up, obviously trying to look like she's not stressed AF. And that was my take from it. Because, like, the type of guy that he is, he doesn't mind sleeping around and then lying about it, because that's what he did when she first walked in. So this probably wasn't even the first time that she suspected, you know, infidelity, which is probably why they're getting a divorce. But it doesn't sound like she's the one who wanted a divorce. It sounds like he is.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. I didn't even think about the fact that the gaslighting might have been passed down to the kids. Like, they have their... like, they got it from him because he had been gaslighting her, and she got to that. Oh, my God. That makes a lot of sense.
Which would also explain why he felt nothing when she died. He was just like, all right, okay, let's move on.
Right. Right. That could make me even more insane that he was just like, yeah, I'm not crazy. I think Grace is a part of my life. She's a part of your life. And the son is literally looking at him like, what the fuck are you talking about, a part of our life? What do you mean? Like, that was the best part. That was insane. He just really wanted to act like they were not supposed to be traumatized. Then he got in the car when Grace was getting in the car, all happy-go-lucky, like, oh, are you guys ready? Like, what? Do you not have self-awareness, sir, of like what your kids have been through? What it's the mom didn't die from a soul-killing disease. She died from fucking suicide. They are fully aware that this woman is partially responsible.
And then you got to think about the circumstances of them finding her.
Right.
Because even if she didn't have friends or whatever, like, he probably still dropped the kids off at the house, didn't want to come into the house, and they probably found her like that. So that's even more trauma.
Right.
Because the girl was, like, literally screaming about how the mom's not going to make it to heaven. And the dad couldn't grasp the concept because I guess he's not religious. But she was literally like, she's not going to heaven because she committed suicide. And people who commit suicide supposedly don't go to heaven. And he couldn't say nothing. He couldn't say a word. Oh, I hated that. I have never hated a fictional father more.
That man was definitely the villain of this story. It's not even the dude
who's the head of the cult and had everybody kill himself. No. Because he at least believed in something.
And he killed himself, so.
The dad is out here just living. Well, he was out there living several lives. Because what job do you have where you have to be in another entire house for several days at a time? Like, I know he's a writer or whatever, but like.
Right.
I feel like he should have stayed home. He should have stayed at the camp.
Right. He should have just stayed with them and said, you know, I'm going to write from here. Simple. I'm sure he could have asked his job to work remotely. My other thing, too, is, so there were two things. One, I didn't like how the kids were basically punished for what they did. Because it's like, they're just kids. They thought it was innocent. They didn't know that she was that far gone if she was taking off her meds. So the ending had me, like, kind of pissed off. Like, as much as I hated the dad, I didn't want him to die because now they're further traumatized. So I'm just like, oh, my fucking God. Like, they basically punished the kids for being kids. Then being kids and also having trauma. So, like, their trauma and their way to respond and cope with it was getting revenge on this woman who pretty much had nothing to do with why the mom committed suicide. Well, not nothing, but was not solely responsible for that. Then, or wasn't at all responsible, I'll just say that. Nobody was responsible. She did what she did on her own free will, but the way it was handled after the fact was fucking stupid. And then the other thing was, there were bullets. There were two bullets in the gun at the end, and I was like, I hope the kids picked up the gun and shot her ass. I hope that she didn't use those two bullets to kill them, because that's an even worse ending. So, yeah. Matter of fact, I'm dropping my 7 to a 6.5 now, just because I didn't like that they punished the kids. I didn't like that.
I didn't like that either, because, like, they had to lose their mom. And, like, I just feel like normal kids, I mean, they're not normal because, you know, they had this traumatic event happen to them. But I just feel like how they went about this revenge, I really feel like that wouldn't have happened if this was a real thing. Like, they really took it to the extreme.
Right.
Like, they drove this woman insane. Because, like, I was behind the kids 100% until it was completely revealed that they were making this up. And I'm like, how could you do something like that and expect not to be punished? Although I didn't want the dad to die either. Magically, I didn't want him to die because I wanted the kids to have their parent.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought they should have been tortured in some way. Like, the rest of the time they were there, she, like, you know, it would have been amazing if she just tortured them back. Like, she was just like,
yeah,
all right, I'm about to fuck with y'all now. Like, the whole killing of the dad was just, like, too much.
That's what had my feelings going back and forth, because I was like, I want to be on the kid's side. But then they played this prank on somebody who they knew was, like, affected by this event. Maybe they didn't know she was affected, because how would you? They just know about her past and think she's hiding. Yeah. But at the same time, I'm right. Like,
as a kid.
You know, when you stole all this stuff, you knew she was on pills. So in your head would be like, okay, something isn't right. After I saw that, I probably would have been like, nah, maybe we shouldn't do this. But I'm quick to bow out of a lot of things that are vengeful and hateful like that. Because honestly, there's really no point to it. For me, there's no point. Like, you doing this isn't going to bring back your mom. It's not going to remarry your mom and dad. Y'all not going to go back to being your little family of four. So...
But this is why I say they did it with the brains of a fucking kid kids under grief, like dealing with grief, and the only response they knew was, I'm angry at you because you are the reason my mom did this and why they weren't together and that's why this happened to her. Like, that's what they were thinking of, and their underdeveloped brains could only think of that. So I was just like,
yeah,
y'all deserve to be punished, but not in this way. The dad... He needs to go straight to hell. Like, I hope he figured out that hell does exist.
How could you do this to mom? They still love that man. They just didn't like her. And I hate that as well, because that often happens in situations of infidelity where the man is free of all blame and the woman is just hated.
Yeah, because the fact that they were still going to his house and everything and they're not like, fuck you, dad. Like, I was like, man, y'all should be blaming him too. Fuck ass. But that's why I was happy that I can't remember his name, the son.
Aiden.
And he was like, fuck you. I was like, yeah.
But yeah, this movie brings out a lot of emotions. And if you do watch it, just be prepared for the emotional ride.
Word. Definitely, definitely prepare yourself. Especially in the beginning when it just quickly goes to shit.
Now I need that glass of Alka-Seltzer water to settle my stomach.
For real, for real. Okay. So, from this movie, I remembered back when... So there was a podcast that I was listening to called Dirty John. And Dirty John... was its own story in itself. This guy, he was very manipulative and ended up getting killed because of all the gaslighting and manipulation he caused. And also just showing his true colors eventually and sort of not being fully violent, but violent enough where someone felt that she needed to defend herself. And because, you know, he was stalking her and then came upon her to kill her, and she killed him. And I guess he went after the smallest girl and she killed him. So off of that, you know, Netflix created a series. And so they came out with another one on the podcast, which was another Dirty John, but about Betty Broderick. And so I listened to the podcast first. And then I saw the Netflix series. So if you're interested in either, Dirty John, the first season is on Netflix, and so is the Betty Broderick one. Personally, I like the first Dirty John. Betty Broderick, I don't think I was expecting for it to come out, and when I did watch it, it did get crazy, but it didn't feel as like I didn't want anything bad to happen to her as much as I wanted the other guy, something bad to happen to him. They made her like too sympathetic, so by the end of it, I was like, damn, Betty. But with the other guy, I was like, fuck him. He deserves everything he gets. So, yeah. If you're interested in watching them, they're both still on Netflix. But I say all that to say, I'm going to talk about the story of Betty Broderick because it had a lot to do with manipulation and gaslighting, just like in The Lodge. So, in 1965, Elizabeth, or Betty, met her future husband, Dan Broderick. He was born 1944. At the University of Notre Dame, Indiana. Dan was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He was the eldest son of a very large Irish Catholic family, and they married on April 12, 1969, at the Immaculate Conception Church in Tuckahoe, New York. Tuckahoe. Betty returned from the honeymoon pregnant with their first child, daughter Kim. She was born in 1970. She gave birth to four more children, daughter Lee, sons Daniel and Rhett, an unnamed boy who died 4 days after birth. So she already had some form of trauma. After Kim's birth, Dan completed his medical degree. He then announced his intention to combine his medical expertise with a JD degree and enrolled at Harvard Law School. Betty was the main provider for the family while Dan attended law school with the help of a student loan. You could kind of already see where this is going.
Dang, she's the breadwinner and she's popping out kids like this? Goodness.
Mm-hmm. Dan was quickly hired by a law firm in San Diego, California, and moved his family to the San Diego community of, I want to say La Jolla, but La Jolla, maybe? Jolla. I'm going to say La Jolla. Betty continued working part-time, often selling Tupperware or Avon products while raising the children. So in the fall of 1982, Dan hired 20-year-old Linda Colquena, who was born in 1961. She was a former Delta Airlines flight attendant, to be his legal assistant. As early as October 1983, Betty suspected that Dan was having an affair with Colquena, but Dan denied it. Against Betty's wishes, Dan moved out in February 1985, because at that point, she just kept accusing Dan, and he was like, I'm not doing anything, blah, 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 you know the drill. He eventually took custody of their children after Betty left the children on his doorstep one by one. She just, like, couldn't deal. She was doing everything by herself, and he was literally doing nothing. He was just, you know, still, I think he was, like, at this point, fully in his law firm, and, like, taking charge, and I think at this point also became president of, I forgot what it's called, but he was prominent, let's just say that. So at that point, Betty claimed that Dan confessed he had in fact been having an affair with Colquena, and a long drawn out and hostile divorce ensued. Now this is where everything goes crazy. Those who knew Daniel and Elizabeth Broderick and were familiar with the hurt caused by their protracted divorce case, indicated that it was often feared that their differences would end, as Daniel Broderick had once predicted, it's not going to end until one of us is gone. That was some goddamn foreshadowing right there. Friends of Elizabeth Broderick described her as a woman scorned. After 16 years of marriage to Daniel Broderick, a pillar in the San Diego's legal and social community, she felt suddenly cast aside when their marriage unraveled. She also was sort of worried because she was raised in a Catholic family in Connecticut. Elizabeth, at that point, she was 41, suddenly worried that she would no longer fit into what one friend called the prim and proper junior league type. So she was worried about her money, her social status, everything pretty much. Further frustrating to Elizabeth was the fact that her ex-husband, through his command of the law and influence in local legal circles, was able to contain custody of their four children and court orders sealing their divorce records. But of course, you know, from her side, she was saying she was overwhelmed. She dropped each of them on the doorstep one by one, and eventually that made it even greater cause for him to get custody of them. Two friends, one close to Elizabeth, the other close to Daniel, said that Elizabeth had most recently been upset about not being able to see the two younger children on Halloween night. Friends of Daniel and Linda Broderick, Linda being the new wife now, said their new life together was tormented by Elizabeth. Oh, before I even say that, one other thing was that on April 22nd, 1989, Dan and Colquena were married on what would have been his and Betty's wedding anniversary. Colquena had been concerned about Betty's behavior and even urged Dan to wear a bulletproof vest to their wedding. However, Betty did not arrive and the wedding proceeded without incident. After the wedding, Betty claimed that Linda taunted her by mailing her facial cream and slimming treatment ads because at that point she had gained weight. So I don't even know who's telling the truth at this point, but you may come to a conclusion by the end of all of this. They said that Daniel and Linda began a courtship only after Daniel and Elizabeth separated. Still, the friend said Elizabeth continued to harass them, even as his career as a leading medical malpractice attorney grew. They recalled how she drove her car into his living room window, how she told friends she was taking target practice with a handgun. The friend said that before Daniel and Linda Broderick were married, Elizabeth stole their wedding guest list. Oh, also, with that car driving into his living room window, there were kids present. So yeah, she started slowly losing her mind. And they said she was a familiar face at the courthouse where she allegedly would deface the divorce court records, wherever Linda's name appeared, like literally crossing it out and blacking it out wherever she could. Although the divorce case was closed to the public, the bitterness it engendered made headlines in an article in January in The Reader, a weekly newspaper. According to that article, Elizabeth sought more than $250,000 a year in alimony and child support payments from her ex-husband, who she said earned more than $1 million a year. In an interview with The Times on Monday, Gerald L. Barry Jr., who represented Daniel Broderick in the divorce, said that Elizabeth eventually was awarded $16,000 a month. So obviously not keeping up with her normal lifestyle. The divorce went to trial in December 1988, 4 years after the case was filed. In the midst of the legal proceedings, Daniel Broderick also obtained protective orders aimed at keeping Elizabeth away from his new family. According to The Reader, Elizabeth Broderick ignored some of those orders and was jailed for several days and fined thousands of dollars, one of them being the car being driven into the house. Those who knew Elizabeth said she remained bitter toward her ex-husband. One neighbor of Elizabeth and Daniel Broderick, when they lived in La Jolla, said local housewives were sympathetic to Elizabeth because it appeared she had been dumped for a younger woman, which, I mean, she had. The woman was 28 years old. Yeah, at that point, her friends were saying she did gain a lot of weight, and, you know, she used to be so gorgeous, always slim, blah, blah, blah. I don't know how that means she's not gorgeous anymore, but whatever. And in La Jolla, it's not a pretty picture to be a divorced wife. You don't have any status. There's no place for you. So she probably was, like, literally spiraling. Ed Whitney, an insurance agent who served with Elizabeth on the court-watching group, help abolish legal tyranny, remembered how she stood before their group 6 or 8 months ago and described in detail how she felt Daniel Broderick had used his legal influence in the court system to beat her in the divorce. She mentioned the original court date, Whitney said, that Dan showed up in court and the judge said, "Good morning, Mr. Broderick. To what do we owe this honor?" And I get it, but he could also just know these people because he's part of a law firm and he's well known at this point. So I don't think that meant that he necessarily had influence, but I also wasn't there. I don't know, the look in the Netflix series, it seemed as if they had a close relationship, so he already seemed on Dan's side, but the Netflix series could also be leaning towards making Betty a villain and not a victim, so who knows?
It's with law firms and like law officers and whatnot and lawyers and blah blah blah, they do tend to know about each other because they're just that nosy. They might not be friends, but they will find out
right
about who, which officer is where, and like which judge is presiding over the case and that kind of stuff. Like they do their homework.
Exactly. So I was like, it might just be that he, I mean, well, I guess that is what they're saying, that he uses legal influence in the court system to beat her in the divorce. Like, maybe he went to dinner with the judge or something, or took him out before the court case, or
he was brown nosing.
Right. Maybe. In the Netflix series, I will say they made it seem like, again, they made it seem like he was a little close to the judge. But a lot of the times it also seemed like Betty was just overanalyzing shit. So it was like half and half kind of. I'll take back the earlier statement that it seemed like they were leaning on Dan's side. It may just be that they were trying to be very neutral, because oftentimes they did make it very apparent that Betty was being gaslit. But at the same time, it also made it seem like Dan was like, "What the fuck is wrong with you? Like, something is wrong." And that she also was presenting that something was really wrong with her. But yeah, so Betty claimed that Dan made it extremely difficult for her to find a lawyer willing to present her in the divorce, which also put her at a distinct disadvantage. This was when she went to trial, but I'll tell you what she went to trial for later. Betty also believed that Dan used his legal influence to win sole custody of their children, sell their house against her wishes, and cheat her out of rightful share of his income. So all of that stuff happened. The divorce was finalized in 1989, 4 years after Dan filed the petition. It was a very long, drawn-out divorce, and it was like the talk of the town and the talk in media because it was just insane that they were going through this and that they were equally giving each other a hard time. During this time also, like, people were continuously saying her behavior was becoming increasingly erratic. She left hundreds of profane messages on Dan's answering machine and ignored numerous restraining orders that forbade her from setting foot on Dan's property. So at this point, now Linda Broderick, his new wife, she confided in a friend that this bad situation was becoming worse. She had become accustomed to the constant intrusive role Betty played in her life, but now she was, like, scared to death. Books were disappearing from her bedside stand right next to the bed. She indicated to a lawyer and friend of Dan and Linda that they were surprised by the ex-wife in the house one night. And then she had asked the lawyer, his name was Marshall Hockett, to speak to Dan about it, and he didn't. And the lawyer was like, I'll probably regret that for the rest of my life. But it's like, yeah, I mean, she's being stalked. So, like, you should have taken it seriously.
She literally showed up in the house and they told you to talk to the guy about it. Why wouldn't you? Why did you choose not to? That doesn't make sense.
Right. Yeah. So they could have took precautions and they literally couldn't. So, yeah. There was also, I believe, during the divorce trial, Betty represented herself without an attorney. Many people believed it was, like, unfair and only solidified Dan's clout in the local legal area. And even though the trial was completely, like, sealed off from the public, I don't know. It just seemed like a lot of people knew about it. And I forgot this part, that by the end of it, Betty owed Dan $750,000 in Epstein's and cash advances, all accrued between the time Dan moved out and the date the divorce was final on January 30th, 1989. So at the end of it, she owed him money. And he eventually had to pay his ex-wife less than $30,000 in cash. So it was the $16,000. I think it got increased once, but it was still less than $30,000. And he was reawarded custody of the children because at one point Betty had gotten custody of them again because the judge sympathized with her, but then he took it back. So at that point, she felt like her life was completely over. So all of that context was to say how this tragic thing ended up happening. 8 months after buying a Smith & Wesson revolver and 7 months after Dan and Linda were married, Betty Broderick drove to Dan's house at 1041 Cypress Avenue in San Diego. Betty used a key she had taken from her daughter Lee to enter the house while the couple slept, whereupon she shot and killed them. And she really manipulated her daughter into getting that key from them. The murders occurred at 5:30 a.m. on November 5th, 1989, 2 days before Betty's 42nd birthday. Two bullets hit Linda in the head and chest, killing her instantly. One bullet hit Dan in the chest as he apparently was reaching for the phone. One bullet hit the wall, and one bullet hit a nightstand. Dan was 17 days shy of his 45th birthday, and Linda was 28. Evidence was also presented at her trial that Betty had removed the phone or answering machine from Dan Broderick's bedroom so that he could not call for help. Medical evidence indicated that Dan had not died right away, and Betty claimed that she had spoken to him after she had shot him. After contacting her daughter Lee and Lee's boyfriend, Betty turned herself into police, never denying that she had pulled the trigger 5 times. Betty's explanation at both trials was that she never planned to kill Dan and Linda and that her crime was not premeditated. Her account of the murders at her second trial was that she was startled by Kokena screaming, "Call the police," and immediately fired the gun. So in the Netflix series, they did show, like, she was, I don't remember if she was drinking, but she was having a rough night. And so she drove over there with the gun. And I don't know how she didn't say it was premeditated, because it's like, why would you drive over there with a gun if you didn't plan on shooting somebody? But she did, they did show her version of events where it seemed like she got startled by Linda screaming, call the police. So, I don't know.
I feel like my whole thing is, if you're going over to their house, everybody knows what you're going through. Everybody knows, because it's been so long and drawn out and just hectic. Everybody knows what you're going through. They already know you're crazy and you're just hella scorned. So you driving to your ex's house with a gun, and not, you didn't keep the gun in the car, you kept the gun on you, talking about, oh, I just want to talk to them. You had intentions on shooting them. I don't care what anybody say, even if they were not written plans, this was premeditated. The second you stepped out of that car with the gun in your hand or in your pocket or wherever it was, I'm sorry. Like, I feel for her, but like, I can't let you slide on this one, girl.
So, basically, just to touch a little bit on how the lawyers were, well, her defense attorneys were arguing that she suffered psychological abuse at the hands of Dan. First, they were saying he was using his legal influence to cheat her out of her fair share of his 7-figure annual income, because, of course, you know, her argument was that she was supporting him through law school. So it's like part of that money should be hers. Then she was like, he took my home, my kids, my money, and he had a white-collar way of beating her. She's quoted to say to the New York Times in 1991, if he had hit me with a baseball bat, I could have shown people what he did and made him stop. So a lot of the country was divided by this murder. Some people saw Betty as a vicious, cold-hearted murderer, while others questioned and some even sympathized with her claims of mental abuse. So that's why a lot of depictions of Betty Broderick were of her being cold and malicious. But the Netflix version, they were sort of trying to paint her as like, yes, she was somebody who was gaslit, but also like gaslit, made wrong decisions, and should be sympathized with for the mental abuse and psychological abuse she suffered, but also like should be punished because she didn't have to take it this far. So this other article I read was like, you know, saying the person who made the show, Alexandra Cunningham, she reexamined her story through today's view on mental health and emotional abuse. So it wasn't just about like, oh, she just went crazy because he didn't want her anymore. It was, no, he did all of these things and this led up to a buildup of her losing her fucking mind. So it seemed as though Betty had like a long, decades-long fascination with the Brodericks, as far as like their relationship. And it was mainly because even though Linda wasn't necessarily playing a part in the gaslighting, Dan was. He was doing stuff, throwing stuff in their face, like getting married on their wedding anniversary, or around their anniversary. I forget what else, but like there were a lot of things that I'm trying to find it, but there were a lot of things that he was in charge of how she was losing her mind versus like her just being randomly jealous. So, okay, remember I said like they had a baby and it died days later. She grew up in that time where, you know, you can't really ask for help. Like, she's just expected to get over it. So she didn't have any resources. So at the time when he left her, she was slowly stirring into madness because she had kids. She couldn't really get over the death of her baby on her own. And then, like, you know, him being never home and then him not being grateful for her taking care of the home was, you know, getting to her. So she just always brushed things under the rug and never really said anything. And then eventually it just made her crack. And that was the first crack. So the second crack was when she realized she wasn't as attractive to him anymore and he didn't really want to touch on her. But he constantly gaslit her and made it seem like he still wanted her and that he wasn't cheating on her. And the reason why, because he's tired and all these other things. And then eventually finding out that he left and said, oh, it's because the marriage isn't doing well. Yeah, you left, but now you're with this woman. And then now you're going to tell me that y'all are getting married. Like, there was just a whole lot of gaslighting throughout it, throughout their divorce trial. The divorce trial was even worse because then he also painted her as, like, this woman who was constantly harassing them. And she wasn't even harassing them yet. She had started to because she wanted to figure out a way to get, like, custody taken away from him because he had manipulated her into giving the kids away. So there was just a lot of stuff that he was doing that was, like, brushed under the rug with a lot of the articles about the two of them that led up to the homicide. When people were doing research, they only talked about, like, yeah, she just was so jealous and she killed them. It's like, no, like, he was literally fucking with her and that led to his death.
Bro, what's crazy is that, like, not one person in that courtroom was like, if it wasn't for this woman, you would not have these kids or your law degree or your fancy job where you earn 6+ figures a year. You wouldn't have none of this.
That's the sad part. She was doing that herself. She was the person saying that for her, and everybody was looking at her like she was crazy.
Mm-hmm. She was the one who put him through all it. Like, she maintained a house, gave you kids, and let you go to school forever, because it is not a quick little, oh, 2-3 years, and boom, you have a law degree. No. This man was in school for a while.
Yeah.
And she helped pay for that and paid to keep the house up and was working her butt off to take care of these kids. And then you just go off and do whatever because of whatever. Like, that's so, that's so insane to me. And then people wonder why women don't do that, or, like, women who do it nowadays are seen as, like, fools or idiots. And it's just, it's crazy because, like, that's, I feel like that's what you do for someone that you really love. Like, you're willing to give all that you have to make sure that they're good. And the unfortunate thing was that he probably never even loved her, because there was just no signs of, like, him reciprocating that. Like, people think that a guy giving you a baby is means he loves you. No, it doesn't.
Well, I didn't really talk about it much, but in the Netflix series, they did paint it as, like, he was very doting at first.
Of course they're going to paint it like that. He was probably just being that way just to get her to do the stuff, to start doing.
Yeah, I think that's what it was. I think it was, like, he didn't have the money or the influence yet, so he was able to dote on her and appreciate her and all that stuff. But then as soon as he got into law school, it was like he became cold and no longer cared about the marriage. He got what he wanted and he felt like, I did what I had to do as a husband. Now I'm doing something for me as a career man, and stopped doting on her. Because there was, like, a whole scene where, like, she was pregnant. He started, like, rubbing her feet. I was like, no, that's above and beyond, honestly, because most men don't know that the feet be hurting when women are pregnant.
Which doesn't make sense. But, you know.
Right.
That's just one of those things. Nah, but Netflix has a way of, like, romanticizing a lot of stuff. So.
They do.
You have
they
to do. Take these documentaries or whatever they put up with a grain of salt.
Yeah, I think that's why at one point I was like, y'all are kind of trying to paint Betty as a villain. But at the same time, I get it, because it's like she did go really far. But at the same time, I'm like, I don't like how they're making it seem like she just went crazy, when it was like, it's obvious that he is doing things to piss her off and make her seem crazy so that he can get what he wants. But yeah, I was very interested in the story. So if you're interested, just search up the Dirty John podcast if you don't really care about watching, like, the fictionalized version. Or you can watch the fictionalized version on Netflix.
I'll have to check it out. This almost felt like we were talking about the movie we watched, but it was, like, so, it was insane, just like the movie.
Right. It is. It really is with the amount of gaslighting and manipulation parts.
Gaslighting. Like, that's the word of the day. But the movie that we watched, they love to talk about purgatory.
Mm-hmm.
Because the whole part of the prank was the son trying to create a sense of them being in purgatory or limbo, which, if you don't know what that is, it's kind of like the space. Well, in my definition, it's the space between realms. Like, you're not alive, but you're not really like in your afterlife yet. You're kind of like in the hallway and there's nothing mm-hmm. there, and you're like wandering aimlessly. And then, like, a lot of I think in like Catholicism, it's like there's like three different purgatories, and it's weird. It's like one is for the people who are basically just waiting in line to go to hell, and then one is what they call the purgatory for infants. And I guess these are children who, or children who just die as children, or like die in the womb or whatever. And then they have the purgatory of fathers, or the purgatory of the patriarch, which is basically what they make it sound like is like a room. A spiritual room where all of the people who died before, all of the men who were like prophets or whatever, who died before Jesus was said to have died for everybody's sins. And they were kind of just like in the waiting room. And they were like, oh, waiting for him to die for everybody. They're like, oh, okay, now we all can move on to go to heaven. It's just this weird how they explain it. But it's like they had... It's like a lot of verses in the Bible that talk about waiting for Jesus to come to get them and take them to heaven. But they're not talking about while they're on earth. And it's interesting. But that's not what I'm talking about. Because I thought about it. I thought about talking about the idea of purgatory and where it came from and all that other stuff. But it's a lot of like religion involved, and you got to go with Catholicism and Judaism and whatever. And I'm like, we're not doing that. So what I wanted to talk about was the people who are able to see the spirits in their purgatory or in limbo, pretty much. And that's otherwise known as mediums. Or psychic mediums or whatever. I think that's what they call them. And the practice of mediumship, which is the practice of purposely mediating communication between familiar spirits or spirits of the dead and living human beings. And we've seen this in like everything. You probably have like street corners where like there's always like a psychic shop or whatever. Which I definitely want to go to one day. One day. I want to see a medium. But the practitioners of mediumship are called mediums or spirit mediums. There are different types of mediumships or spirit channeling, including seance tables, trances, and Ouija boards, or just Ouija in general. So mediumship gained popularity during the 19th century when Ouija boards were used as a source of entertainment, which I still don't understand that. Who was out here like, oh, here's a Ouija board for my kid. Let them play with it. What do you...
Like, no. Like, no.
Even if you didn't know that it could possibly contact spirits, it's a board with letters on it and some weird piece in the middle. There's
nothing. It says it on that shit. It is a spirit messaging board. It says something like that.
This board with one piece to it. That looks like something you should buy for your kids.
Right.
But yes. Investigations during this period revealed widespread fraud, with some practitioners employing techniques used by stage magicians, and the practice began to lose credibility. Several different variants of mediumship have been described. Arguably, the best known forms involve a spirit purportedly taking control of a medium's voice and using it to relay a message, or where the medium simply hears the message and passes it on. Other forms involve materializations of the spirit or the presence of a voice and telekinetic activity. Attempts to communicate with the dead and other living human beings, aka spirits, have been documented back to early human history, such as the biblical account of the Witch of Endor. Now that is insane. Actually, yes, let's go into that, because I did hear about this the other day. I was watching the show Haunted History, and one of the episodes was about the Dybbuk, which is like the Jewish demon or devil that is usually like trapped in some kind of box or container.
Yeah.
And they talked about the Witch of Endor, which I was like, this sounds like something from Lord of the Rings or something. But, yeah, so the Witch of Endor is a woman who, of course, according to the Hebrew Bible, was consulted by Saul to summon the spirit of the prophet Samuel. So that was, like, the first account of, like, mediumship. And Saul wished to receive advice on defeating the Philistines in battle after prior attempts to consult God through sacred lots and other means had failed. But when they summoned the spirit of Samuel, he only delivered a prophecy of doom. And he was like, wallin'. And they were like, all right, let's not do this again.
I'm like, how y'all gonna get mad at me for delivering the truth?
It's like, he was mad they brought him back, like, angry. Or so it was said. So that's like one of the earliest forms of mediumship. And then, like, you have your popular shows, like the, what is it called, the Long Island Medium, the lady with the big I watched a couple episodes of that.
I've seen it in passing and been like, I don't know about her, but at the same time, it's like, it could very well be true. I can't suspend disbelief about mediums for some reason.
But yeah, it's like I want to say on behalf of mediums, like, it's super hard for any legit ones to like make a living, because there's so many like frauds out there. And if there are real mediums, like, I would definitely want to meet one.
Yeah, it's like, I would, and then I feel like, you know, you're supposed to suspend disbelief so that, like, they can, you know, read you, and then you're open, if you're open-minded, like, oh, okay, yeah, that does seem accurate, versus, like, completely mistrusting, you're gonna think everything is just a coincidence, and I feel like that's me. Like, I'm like, no, I feel like you're just reaching, and that so happens to fit my life right now. Like, I feel like that would be me.
I feel like that too. And then I'm also like, I feel like I'm one of those people who are like super vulnerable, but also I feel a lot of things heavily. So the second you say something and it hits me, all of a sudden I'm like, whoa. You hook, line, and sinker. That's me.
Right. It also depends. Like, if you're super specific about something, like, oh my God. I remember this lady scared the shit out of me in DR. She just randomly came up to me and my friends. She, like, read our friend. Like, not read her, but, like not reading her palms or anything, but she just said, you know, I see something in you, and then just, like, started going in about, like, oh, I know you're struggling with this and this and blah, blah, blah. And the girl started crying, and me and my other friend were just like... Like, 2 seconds later, she turns to me, and it was just so specific. I was just like, How the fuck do you know that? How do you know that? Like, she, okay, so if I don't know if I've discussed this with a lot on here, but I've probably discussed it with you and other people in my life, so this may sound familiar if you know, but so I used to have, sometimes still do, like weirdly prophetic dreams. Like something would either be very literal happening in my dream where it's like a prediction of what's about to happen, and then it would happen and it used to freak me out. And then it would also be like this very like figurative dream happening, and then all of a sudden, like later on, I'd be like, oh, that figurative dream related to this thing. That's crazy. So yeah, I'd have dreams like that. And it used to freak me out, but also I did not like, I guess I realized it young, but I did not like being the helpful friend of like, I'm always helping people with their problems and they never listen to me about mine. So I realized that very young and decided I was not going to do that anymore. Because I also realized it when random strangers would walk up to me and start telling me their story.
Oh my.
And I'd be like, like, I did not ask to be a part of this like session with you.
Bro,
but it always happens.
I hate that. And that's so true. I wonder if that's like something that runs in our family, because I swear to you, I will look as bummy as I possibly can. Headphones yeah. in, just trying. Like, I have the natural, like, mean mug when I'm like, especially when I'm in New York. And all of a sudden, somebody just walks over to me and has a whole conversation.
Right. And it's always that. It's always they want to spill their life story to you. And I'm just like, bro. And because I'm nice, I'm just like being a good listener and listening. But the whole time in my head, like, can you please leave me alone?
And like,
leave me alone.
My grandparents were often like telling me like to listen to people, hear them out, hear their stories, because you never know what you might learn from them. So I've always been that type of person. Like, I'll like roll my eyes when they start talking, but then I'm like, here we go, let me actually listen to what's being said. And I've learned that that's apparently, like, a lot of people have, like, sat and talked to me about their lives, and at the end of each story, it's always been the same message to me. So I don't know if that's, like, something that I need to hear constantly or what, but, like, I just, every time it happens now, I'm like, here we go. What message is it this time?
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's, like, I'm very understanding of people and very non-judgmental, so that's why people will often like talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I started to hate it, because when I was ready to talk to somebody else, nobody wanted to listen. So eventually I just became like this person, I don't give a fuck about your story, I don't want to hear it. Like, don't tell me it. I'm going to do exactly what you're doing to me. I'm going to be on my phone not listening to you. I don't care. And then I kept my headphones on all the time in public. And if somebody starts trying to speak to me, I would purposely act like I can't hear them, even though they're right next to me. Because I was like, I'm no longer giving that energy up. Right? And then I also asked God to stop giving me those dreams, because it scared the shit out of me. So I just asked for every single one of those things to happen. So to go back to the story, the lady was like, you have this gift of healing people and hearing them out, and it really helps them, and you've been blocking it for a long time. And I just sat there and stared at her like, why the fuck do you know this? Why the fuck do you know this? She could have very much just been very lucky about what she was saying, but it's just like, nah, bro, nah.
You're like, who you been talking to? No, but I'm saying, like, it's not just that, because, like, it could have been brushed off if she had just stopped at, like, oh, you have this gift of healing people.
Right.
But the fact that she added on that you've been blocking it, that's a little seasoning on it.
That's the part that had me like, whoa, what do you mean? What do you mean? Like, when she said that, like exactly what you just said. Before, I was just like, okay, whatever, yeah, I got this gift, okay. But as soon as she said, as soon as she said, you've been blocking it, you need to accept that this is who you are and that you cannot shut that out in your life, that is what puts you, that's what you put on the world as your purpose, I said, stop it right now. I got so mad in that moment because I was like, what ancestor, spirit guide, whoever sent you down to tell me this shit? I don't like it.
Right. But that's why we need to go. I want to go to a meeting or some psychic or whatever. Like, I want to just to see, because I've never had that experience and I want to.
Well, I want to go to an Orisha, which is like, hold on. I got to remember the exact thing, but it's its own, I guess, like in Yoruba culture, which is in Nigeria. Orishas are seen as like emissaries of God, right? So they're the ones that work with spirits, kind of like a medium, and will tell you, okay, you need to do this in order to fix your life. You need to stop worrying about this. You need to, this is your purpose in life, or this is the medium that you're supposed to be practicing in your life. Like, you think candle work is your thing, but it's actually not. It's this, because this is what your ancestors are telling me. Like, they're those. And so I kind of wanted to see an Orisha to tell me, like, what should I be working with? Because I did buy tarot cards, but I also feel like I'm able to read other people with tarot cards and not my own self. And I want something where I can read myself. Also, because some people believe that they're spiritual healers, or, I mean, not spiritual healers, but some people believe that they can do spells. I may not be a person that does spells, so when I do them, I'm like, am I doing the wrong thing? Does this actually work for me? Who knows? So I want to go to an Orisha for her or him to tell me if I'm supposed to be doing these things, or what should I take on? Because even then, sometimes people go to Orishas and find out that, yeah, you're a powerful manifester, but the way you're doing it is all incorrect. Or the way you decided to do it, like, you think you're supposed to be in hoodoo, but you're actually supposed to be in this thing. And I'm like, I kind of want to figure it out. So, yeah, that's the only person I want to go to.
Interesting. I had never heard of an Orisha before, but
yeah,
it's, I would be
pretty cool. I did a lot of research on them during the pandemic because I was interested in hoodoo.
We are still
my ancestors and people. True. I mean, you know what I mean. Like, when we were all shut down, like in our homes, yeah. I got very
most of us were consumed with, some of us were still out there suffering.
Yeah, so that's what happened with that lady. She scared me. But yeah, since then I've been like, I don't want no medium telling me I gotta be a healer again, because if I do, I better be around the right motherfucking people, because we are not gonna do that again. I will shut that shit down so quick. Nope, don't want to hear it. Have you ever listened to my problems? No, you haven't. So.
Well, that's the thing about being a healer. It's like, they come to you for healing. But then it's like, who heals the healer? Like, who delivers mail to the mailman?
Right. And that's the thing. Eventually, you get a friend in your adult life that becomes that for you, like eventually my friend did, and I became that for her as well. But now it's like, you don't want to burden people, so you need somebody that's also a healer as your friend to be like, I'm also gonna listen.
God, this circle of healers is getting bigger and bigger.
But yeah, that's cool. I, for some reason, I don't know why I didn't think that mediums work with purgatory. well, spirits in the purgatory. I just thought that they were calling them from wherever they were at.
It's like, because you can't access a spirit that's, like, already moved on. They have to be wandering. And there's different, everybody's got a different belief of what purgatory or limbo is. But it all, the whole general concept is that the spirit is stuck or lost. And it's trying to find its way out, or it's trying to deliver a message because it can't leave unless this message has been sent. And things like that. And that's the whole talk about them being in limbo and purgatory because they're super religious. Made me
think best that. Interpretation I saw of like purgatory and heaven and hell was I will never forget this exhibit because it literally stuck with me. But in college, I think it was my friend Ebony had to go to this exhibit for like credit for a class. So I went with her because I already liked museums. So I was like, why not? And DC museums are free. So we decided to go. Yeah, I love it. They're free. I actually miss like going there. But yeah, so we went to, I forget which museum it was, but it was probably like the regular Smithsonian. But we went and they had a exhibit called The Divine Comedy. And it was like each floor was like the first floor, I believe, was heaven. Second floor was purgatory. And then last one was hell. So you start off in heaven. Everything looks like all pretty. All the paintings and sculptures are like nice. And I was like, okay, yeah, this seems very heaven-like. When you get to purgatory, the sense of dread, I was like, absolutely not. I would never, like, purgatory is exactly what I imagined when I looked at that exhibit. And I was like, I never want to be stuck there. It looks basically like hell. Like, it's just, like, the emptiness. There was one thing, I can't remember if it was in the hell one or purgatory, actually, but it was, like, this sculpture, it's going to sound really vulgar, but this sculpture of, like, a whole bunch of bodies having sex with each other in different positions, but the way that it was looked like somebody was consumed with lust. And it was overpowering them. And, like, that's what their thing that was making them stuck. It was purgatory. That's the thing that was making them stuck in purgatory was that they had this, like, I don't know if you would call it an addiction or they couldn't find love in life. So all they could be stuck with the feeling of was lust. Like, it was just so, like, when you look at it, you don't think perversion. You think, like, what the fuck? Like, oh, my God. Like, this is what lack of love looks like.
Oof.
Yeah, it was crazy. There were a bunch of exhibits down there. Well, that was the main one I remembered because that was the one that, like, creeped me out the most. Like, as much as it was supposed to be, like, vulgar, when you really look, like, take a step back from it, you're like, no, that actually seems like a very scary thought. Like, you're just in these positions and things are happening, but nobody's actually communicating or doing it, like, no. I was like, that one was scary. And then there was another one in hell that I can't really remember, but I just remember it obviously being dark down there, but not appearing the way I thought hell was going to look. It was like, at first it started off stereotypical, like, oh, a fire, but then when you go into the actual exhibit, it was like hell was more so about what guilts you and what you can't let go of. And I like that interpretation of hell more than what people say, like, you just forced to go down there and, like, live for eternity. Like, no, their interpretation of hell was like, if you don't deal with the things that are guilting you or that you can't let go of, you will stay down there.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's how most of them seemed. So yeah, I liked it.
My interpretation of purgatory, because I grew up Christian and going to church all the time. I mean, I still go to church, but I always thought that, like, if heaven is above us and hell is supposed to be below us, that it would make sense if where we are right now is purgatory.
Yeah, I've heard that interpretation too. I could also agree with that.
That's how I've always thought of it, because, like, it just seems so mundane, so routine, until, you know, you die and you're gone. So it's like, it kind of makes sense. Like, we have to move on. So this would make sense that this was the level of where we were stuck at for a while.
Some people also believe this is hell.
I've heard that interpretation a lot. And I said, there's no way. Like, hell has to be more exciting. So everybody experiences their own hell. Mm. So that would also make sense. Yeah,
that's how the show Lucifer shows, which also kind of aligns with the interpretation from the museum, was that Lucifer was showing that, one, if you don't let go of your guilt, you'll never move on to heaven, but also that everyone has their own personal hell because they have their own personal guilt that they deal with.
Mm-hmm.
That also reminded me, I saw the documentary Miss Cleo on HBO Max, and she got a bad rep, man. I actually kind of respect her. Like, I get that there was, like, the whole scam going on, but I kind of respect her a little bit. It was an interesting documentary. They were basically talking about how she was, like, revered and also, what's the word? I guess hated. Like, everybody was split on her, especially after it was revealed that the little TV program, psychic call thing company that she was a part of was a scam. So they hated her for it. But it was like, she technically did not have any attachment to that shit. But yeah, it was good.
It also reminded me of the show Good Omens. It is a very, 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 very good show. And it covers this concept of, like, basically an angel and a demon are both sent to Earth to do the work of their rulers. And they're not supposed to know that the other is there, but they've been on Earth for so long that they eventually find each other, and they keep bumping heads, and then they're like, why do we keep fighting? Like, we're just going to keep doing this over and over and over and over. And then they basically decide to become friends and tackle a bigger evil. But it's the best show. And it makes you think about it a lot. And then, of course, the belief is that they've only been on the planet 6,000 years, which I think is the same time frame in, like, religions, where I think it's Christianity that believes that the earth is only like 6,000 years old or so. So yeah, there's a lot of, like, religious stuff or whatever, but it makes it interesting. It is very interesting. And their depiction of hell, it's not really on fire. Well, yeah, he goes to hell because he has to, like, meet with the Beelzebub or whatever. But it's not on fire. Everything's just gross and scary. And it's a good show. I think it's a good show. And then, like, the angel goes to heaven to meet with the archangels. And it's just an office building painted in all white. And everybody's got nice suits on. And they're all smiling. But there's nothing behind their smiles. It is very empty. So it's, and John Hamm is in it, so
yeah,
you already know.
Man, this also reminds me of The Good Place. I love
it's pretty good. Yeah, it's similar to that, except it's shorter. I have to watch The Good Place too.
Yeah, The Good Place is mad long. I ain't gonna hold you.
Yeah, this isn't that long. It's like maybe 8 episodes. Yeah, and once you get past episode 1, like, for me, all of it just flew by. Like, I was able to watch it in, like, one sitting because I was obsessed. But yeah, you get pretty interested pretty fast.
But yeah, that's it from us indefinitely. Sad, but like, you know, I think we can say that, you know, we did this and we put a lot of effort into it, and I'm glad I did it. I don't know about Laurel, but but like, I'm proud of what we did.
We've been doing this for like almost 2 years now. Time really does fly.
It does. So when we go on our Facebook page, I see the first video we put out, which was like our intro video, and I'm like, damn, look how short the hair was. Can't even fit them into a bonnet now.
Literally, I have to go up a size like every day.
But yeah, please always remember to stay safe.
Stay indoors.
And don't leave your foot off the bed.